have an introduction, and then we can sort of turn it over to have people ask me questions or just relate your experiences and all. But first of all, just by way of introduction, my wife read the notice that was emailed out to the Sangha about this thing, and she said, "What does it mean to betray Buddhism?" And I said, "Well, it means to, you know, turn someone off to it or make someone not want to do it." She said, "Oh, okay, okay." But it made me realize that not everyone has the backstory of what prompted this event. And here's the backstory, is that over the years, I've heard from Sangha members relating that they were asked, they went home at Christmas, or they went home for a wedding or whatever, and they were asked, "What is Zen? What is Buddhism?" And I've been troubled that how many people have said, "I didn't know what to say, so I just didn't say anything." Well, sometimes saying nothing is a good response, but not that often. it is an opportunity. Whatever benefits any of us have gotten out of practice, wouldn't we want more people to get the same benefits if they feel an affinity with it? And Kit, actually, one of our committee meetings, Kit suggested that we could have this session. And so we're going to try it. And it's going to be rough, I think. It's going to be kind of a little disorganized. It's the first time we've tried it. Kind of as a pilot session, we'll just probably be able to refine it and get it better organized for future ones. And I think there will be future ones, because not everyone can be here today, I know, who wanted to be here today. We can just sort of wade into it. Yesterday, just to get the pump primed, I polled the staff at a staff meeting, the residents, what kind of questions they've heard or asked or been asked. And I do have a list. We just scribbled down the kind of questions that the staff offered as the ones they've had to face. So that's one way to get the ball rolling. But before we do, I just want to speak to the larger issue of responding to questions without getting into any specifics right now. First of all, the most important thing is to present Zen as a reality in your questions. You can still answer doctrinal questions, you can give specific answers, but it's the way you respond that has the greatest impact on people. There's someone once said, they'll forget what you said, they'll forget what you told them to do, but they won't forget how you made them feel. And this is a real basic principle in Zen. It's not the answer. This is with koans too. It's not the answer that matters so much. It's what's behind the answer, and your energy field, the way you respond, that will have the most impact on the person. With any question, there can be, debate about whether that was a good answer or this answer might have been better. I would hasten to say also that there ever is just one answer, one correct answer. So much depends on the way whether you're calm and centered and grounded and non-defensive and some other things that I'm going to point out here. Listening. Someone presents you with a question. Part of that kind of meta response that I just mentioned about your energy field is the degree to which you're listening to them and not just coming out with some standard, doctrinal answer, but really listening and looking to to see where they're coming from. Many of you know this. This is an answer. If two people ask exactly the same question for this person, it would be more appropriate to answer in such and such a way, and for this person in a different way. It depends on where they're coming from. This is a big point in koan, in the koan work, is where is this person? Is it a beginner? Is it someone trying to trap you into some, you know, an argumentative person? Some of the questions that the staff came up with yesterday came from kind of debates. Someone from another religion trying to, what about that? And that's very different than, what about that? It's not so much the person's state of mind when behind the question, whether it's sincere, whether it's a genuine need or interest or curiosity, or whether they're asking, you know, you have a drink in your hand at a party and they're just, I hear you with the Zen Center. Do you, what's Zen, you know? And they're looking around, looking at the peanut jar or the peanut dish or something. You would answer in a completely different way. You all know this. This is just common sense. But I say this because there's no, even now, there are no definite answers that cut across all cases with the same question. It depends on the person. Another thing, besides in terms of the way your own energy field in responding, is the danger of arguing. Some people will come at you and want to argue. That came up yesterday with the staff, with some of the questions. And generally speaking, in Buddhism and Zen, it's a basic principle: don't argue. You're not going to get anywhere with arguing. Mostly, then there are always exceptions. You might, if you came back with a kind of pushback with something, maybe. But generally, people have to come to this on their own, and it's not to have the clever, knowledgeable answer is usually not, or to try to beat them in a debate is not the way to go about it. And then finally, often the best thing if someone is being argumentative is just to yield. Why? Because you're presenting the Dharma in yielding, in not opposing them. The Dharma is non-oppositional, you can come back with something, and it doesn't have to be oppositional, but then sometimes it's just the most you can, the best answer is just, all right, yeah, okay. For example, one response to the question, what is Zen, is, well, Zen is a way to live in the present moment and not in our thoughts. And then someone might say, I've heard this, I like my thoughts. I get a lot of pleasure out of my thoughts and my fantasies. Roshi Kaplow used to tell the case of someone, a reporter who came to a workshop, and when Roshi laid out the whole problem of living in your thoughts, he said, well, I get some, when I'm shaving, you say, when I'm shaving, just shave. But he said, I get some of my best stories when I'm shaving. And in a case like that, a good answer might be, depends on the person, might be, okay, then if you're happy living in your thoughts and your fantasies, then not, but here it's the way you do it. Okay, if you're happy with that, no. But just, okay, yeah, if that's, because they're not ready to take the next step. And then everything is about readiness. Readiness. Where is the person in there? Are they ready to hear this? Another example, when Roshi Kaplow, before he was Roshi, Philip Kaplow, went to Japan the first time for the Tokyo war crimes trials, he had a little time off during the trials, and he wandered over to a Japanese temple, I think it was Engakuji, and he had heard about Zen temples, and he was curious about it, and he walked through the Zen temple gardens in Japan are like a living art gallery throughout Japan. And he had a lot of interest in art, and so he wanted to go over there and check out this nearby temple garden. And he walked through, and he didn't meet anyone. There were no monks. There was no one there. He was the only one in the garden. But it had such an impact on him that this is a feeling of the place. Again, it's not, they'll forget what you said, they'll forget what you tell them to do, they won't forget how you made them feel. So he walked out of that garden, not having met a person, a single person, but just the vibrations of that place had such an impact on him that he came back, and that's when he began auditing courses on Zen by D.T. Suzuki, and then the rest is history. So this is all by way of just saying it's not in the answers you give. It's primarily, it's in your whole being, what you're presenting at that moment. I do have the some questions. Does anyone have anything you want to throw in before I get to some specific questions that came up in the staff meeting?
Yeah, I would like to say something. Mm-hmm. Just came back, or not just, but 2 weeks ago from Germany. And so I hadn't seen all the folks and friends and family for 2.5 years. And before I spoke at phone with some, and they said, oh, we have a lot of questions. And I got a kind of frightened because how can I answer? And then I totally forgot about it. And then at the end, it was exactly the same what you said. There were some questions, but it was more this being with them and living together with them. And it was really interesting. It was even not an answer for myself, but so to feel this stableness inside. I'm sure with it. It was really nice. It was a really good experience. And it's working.
Yeah. Well, here are some of the questions that came up yesterday, and then people can have more. There was one that came up about residential, for those of us who are in residential training, on staff at the center, these are timeless. Why do you want to escape or retreat from the world? What are you doing to help if you speak of compassion? What's the goal of training? Okay, this... we can just put this off. I'd rather just talk to the staff about this because it is specific to the staff. For people who are not on staff, who aren't living here and doing this as a job, what kind of traction can a challenger get if they say, well, you're practicing Zen, what good is that doing anyone? Well, practicing Zen, you're sitting an hour a day maybe. Is that worse? Is that worse for the world than vegging out in front of the TV or doing a lot of other things that they might are more conventional? So that whole body of questions about career, let's just save that for staff. I'll talk with the staff about that. Well, first of all, what is Zen? Yeah. Before I get to these specific questions, let's take that. What is Zen? What is Buddhism? Why are you meditating? Maybe these are three of the most common questions that we get when we go back and visit our families or working with at work with coworkers or whatever. Zen. One safe way. Well, first of all, I generally. If someone asks a question out of nowhere, I run into someone at a bar mitzvah or something, or I go with my wife, and they ask this kind of a question, I give them the smallest, shortest answer. What is Zen? One way to go is just in terms of linguistically. Well, Zen is a Japanese word that means meditation. And so this is a form of Buddhist meditation. And then they might, you know, look, you know, go for, you know, another drink or something. Okay, then you're done. If they
save that one.
Or they might then say, a form of meditation. Oh, what kind of, you know, meditation is it? Then just little bit to see if they keep asking more questions. And then there are different angles. As John said at yesterday's meeting, there are many angles from which you can talk about Zen and Buddhism, especially Zen. Zen is more ambiguous than Buddhism. Buddhism, what is Buddhism? Well, it's one of the world religions, one of the several major world religions. There are many different kinds of it. Zen, what I practice, is one school. It's the meditation, what's called the meditation school, Zen. Then the question might come up, is Buddha a god? And there, the answer is no, he's not. He himself denied that when someone asked him, are you a god? No. Are you a saint? No. Are you an avatar, which is an incarnation of a god? No. And finally the person said, what are you? And he said, I'm awake. He refused to be pinned down as anything, any kind of a self, basically. And I think that's that can really pique people's interest if you make it right clear from the outset that he didn't consider himself a god. I don't consider him a god. There is no god concept in Zen. Now you're going to either... it's a provocative answer. I first read it in a Time magazine article where they interviewed Roshi Kaplow. This is like 1975. And they said, this in this article, they said, there is no God concept in Zen, Kaplow said flatly. But you notice, it's not the same as saying there's no God. There's no God concept. Now, the question is, can there be a God that's not a concept? Well, all right, that can take us far afield. A related question is Zen a religion? And the way I answer that in workshops is I say it depends on what you mean by religion. If by religion you mean a teaching where there's a supreme being who is beyond human laws and so forth, then no, there is no God concept in Zen. But if by religion you mean a faith that there is a reality that cannot be apprehended, cannot be perceived in any ordinary way with our brains or our senses. Is there some reality that we can experience? And in that sense, you could call it a religion. I've been talking a lot. Maybe we could just turn this into more of a discussion. I got a lot more questions. Yeah.
Well, on the God thing, often I find that I feel hesitant to speak on that issue when I know someone's very strongly religious and we get along and we have a lot of shared values, and I kind of fear in some ways that moment where someone says, you know, so you believe in God, don't you? Or, you know, so I think saying not a God concept, I'm not sure that would... I don't know, because in some ways I feel like it depends on what you mean by
right,
God.
Right.
Or
yeah.
Something.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, I think by saying no, I don't believe in God, in a way that right away then that person feels there's this division between us.
Yeah.
I
agree. I don't think I've ever said that. I don't believe in God. A lot of these things you learn. If you ever listen to answers of politicians, they're asked a question and then they know better usually than to answer directly, because then they lose. If they answer one way, they lose those constituents. If they answer another way, they lose those constituents. So they fudge it. They finesse it. And if I was asked that, do I believe in God? I'd probably say no. But as alternative, it depends on the person. Again, that's the basic thing. It depends on the person. If I didn't think that was a good response for that person, then I might say, well, we don't use that word so much, but we do believe in a higher reality, something that cannot be empirically proven, and we have other words for it. But I think that for those who have a more sophisticated understanding of the word God, not as a guy with a gray beard up in the sky, but a sense of the ineffable, the transcendent reality, then yes, I do believe in that.
Yeah, what I found is often if you really talk to people who are devout Christians, for example, and really get to talking with them, they don't have like this very naive view of God either.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
My
next.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead first.
My background in Kundalini Yoga has taken me a little bit into the Sikh religion a little bit, and their approach into it is a little bit interesting in that there's not so much of a personification of God. They use God like many other religions do. They talk about God, they'll talk to God, but the God concept is essentially the universe, where it's not like an essential cognizant being, and even then they kind of leave it open that, you know, there could be some of that in there, but generally we're looking at the universe, if you take that in a larger sense, as opposed to some personification.
Yeah, and I think that's to give people the benefit of the doubt. That's what I think most of the people who are our friends and family, well, I don't know, I can't speak but about that, but I think a lot of people would see it that way. God is you know, this, not just a guy up in the sky. Still, one of the things that drew me to Zen is that Zen recognizes that whatever name you give it, Buddha nature, Buddha, you know, there's this famous saying in the koans, if you utter anyone who utters the word Buddha should wash out his mouth afterward. Whether it's God or Buddha or true nature, or Buddha nature, essential nature, original mind, original nature, all of these terms, what Zen says is, don't think that that's it. And for me, what always bothered me about the word God is that it's something discreet. Maybe this is just my conditioning, our conditioning, but it's hard for me to hear God as this vast thing.
I think the upshot for me has been essentially, I don't know. I'm finding out.
Yeah.
There's something there, and I really believe that what form that is, I'm not really sure. I'm staying open to it.
That's a great answer. That is a superb answer. There's another form of not so much what you say, but what you're communicating in other ways. If you communicate a questioning mind, then you've got some, you're going to have some dialogue there, and they're going to see, they're going to draw the conclusion, either consciously or unconsciously, that, okay, here's a Zen person who doesn't have all the answers and is searching for the answers. And so what you're communicating is, I'm searching. That's a great answer. Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I just don't know. There's your opening. So I do this meditation, this Zen meditation, as a way to try to understand that kind of a question.
I get asked a lot from people who seem to be searching. You know, they're kind of searching for something to follow, but they're very like anti-religion. They don't want to join a religion. They've had that experience, but they're asking me genuinely, what is it that you're learning? Why are you like you are? Because I really like that. I'd like to be that way. And I put a lot of pressure on myself because I feel like, oh, here's this great opportunity.
Yeah.
Share. And I blow it every time. I have nothing to say or too much. I go into too much detail, you know, and then they get over.
Yeah. Okay, this I've heard 1,000. You're not alone, you know, and I have my own history of that. I think a lot of us have exactly, that's what it prompted this session. But first of all, don't be so sure you blew it. If they are prompted to ask because of something in you again, some calm or something like that, they sense in you, then that's, again, that's the most important thing. And what you say after that is less important. That goes much farther than the answer you give them. Yeah, that's one mistake, is trying to go into too much detail. And that goes back to what I said earlier. Give them a little, just a dab, and then see if they want more. And then another dab, and if they come back for more, then another dab. You know, we come from a tradition where monks had to sit outside the door of the temple for 3 days to prove their sincerity. And so this is mild compared to that, you know. You can keep answering the question. But too much detail is a big danger, I would say. I would say that's more of a danger, that you bury them in explanations. That's worse than just kind of being tongue-tied. Because if you say, generally, I think the less you say, the better. Then they're gonna go by other things, the more important things, is your energy field and how you respond to them and stressful situations. That is really the important thing. So don't be too hard on yourself. I used to be that way too. Oh, I could have said this. I could have said that.
I'd like to add something. This is religion thing. I got a lot of questions. Is this, you are a religious person? Are you joining a religion?
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned to say that it starts for me. I only say it starts for me to be a religion when faith comes in. Before you can practice a Zen, that's simply to be present, to sit. And then when you see that there is something bigger than yourself,
mm-hmm.
then you start to join a religion.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
This I felt was very helpful for a lot of people, because I got the same impression that religion, I don't like to join a religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah. It's closed.
The other thing you can say is, in Zen, you don't believe anything. You don't have to believe anything you haven't experienced.
Yeah, yeah,
so exactly. It's not a religion where you have to believe something because
yeah,
it's written
yeah,
down.
Yeah.
You can find out for yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a great answer. Yeah. And that's what that's what I liked about Zen, is they're not just feeding me dogma and answering my questions. I say this sometimes in a new student ceremony. The job of a Zen teacher is not to answer your questions. It's to help you clarify them so that you can find the answers yourself. And that's so much different than a lot of religions, where they just hand you down the theology and all. But I think that two-part thing you said, Britta, of where it becomes a religion when you have this faith in some transcendent reality, that points to the different aspirations in Zen, that you can practice Zen just to reduce stress.
Yeah, this I explained them to
you.
You don't need to join a religion.
Yeah.
You can sit in.
Yeah, and I try to make this point in workshops, is I say to people, and this is true, say, you don't have to believe a thing about Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Just if you want to just practice Zen, that means practice sitting and practicing it. But it is a big distinction between meditation, Zen meditation, as a stress reduction technique, and meditation as something that can resolve questions. That's another one. While I think of it, have you answered these questions? That sometimes comes afterward, and I think a good answer, I find, is to say, well, they're not bothering me in the same way. I haven't answered them. Maybe it's not a matter of answering them. It's that they're not a problem for me anymore. Yeah.
Roshi, one thing that often when people have asked me about Zen that has gone completely the opposite of the sort of preconceptions I would have had early on, is the people who are most hostile are generally, it's the sort of thing you're talking about, they're people who have this really rationalistic, anti-religious bent. And mm-hmm. Some of the friends who've been the most supportive have been very devout, you know, Christians or Jews. And so, you know, I just bring that up because so often when we talk about this, it sounds like the, you know, there's hostility coming from other religions somehow. And responding to people, I found it's almost the opposite, that it's the people who really are down on what I'm doing tend to be the people with like an extremely intellectual, rationalistic sort of bent.
Yeah.
It's the evil secular humanists.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell them the story you told me in the car yesterday about your friend who, instead of becoming an engineer, wanted to become a psychologist.
This is an old friend of mine. He's a sangha member I've known for 40 years. And his father, who died last year, was an engineer and very into like a rational view of the world. And my friend Andy, he was a math major like I was in college. And his father got so upset just at his wanting to be a clinical psychologist that first he relented. But at first he told Andy, he said, I'm going to take all the money you would have inherited and establish a prize, an annual essay contest on the invalidity of clinical psychology.
So substitute religion or Zen for that. My own parents are very hostile to well, there, at one time there were five of their kids were here.
You know, the army, they don't allow that.
And so let me just, I remember the day, it was a big turning point. I'd been doing this for about 20 years, and my mother finally had softened to the point where she says, well, she, you know, I was a priest by then, and she said, well, all right, Zen is okay as an avocation, but what about a vocation? But it goes back to, in terms of hostility, if someone is hostile, why waste your time? There's nothing, you're not going to get anywhere with them.
But how do you respond? Because I've had close friends who are really hostile. And I mean, one night I said, they asked me a question about Zen, and I said, are you just setting me up to ridicule me again? Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Kids...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you respond? Because I said, would you be happier if I watched Wheel of Fortune in Jeopardy every night?
Can I say?
Yeah.
And I think they would have felt it was like more normal or something. You know, I don't want Zen to make my life smaller.
Yeah.
I don't want to cut people out because they're hostile about my being involved with Zen, but I get it a lot, especially, I'm like a middle-class Jewish woman, and I get it a lot from my and I like those people, but to them, I'm weird. And I don't want to be weird to anyone.
No, you should be. You should say, I'm a little weird, what are you going to do with
me? The John Blaine School of Zen.
Is it?
You haven't figured this out already.
Yeah, but I don't want to say I'm a little weird.
I actually do trainings with Buddhist groups in the San Francisco area. I commute between here and San Francisco a lot, and I've done several trainings with Buddhist groups around communication, and that's a question that has come up a lot. You know,
just give me a blanket answer.
Can I do something a little different with you for just
sure.
a minute?
Okay.
Can I be you and you be your friend? Just for like a minute.
Okay.
Say something.
Okay. So what's wrong with you?
Are you worried about me?
Yeah.
Because of the phase of religion I'm practicing or for other stuff?
This isn't how these conversations... I just don't get it. I just don't get it.
So
that's
like,
what they keep saying. I just don't get
it. So it's confusing, and you want to have more understanding about something that's so important to me. Is that it?
No, I just don't get it. Isn't it, Ellen? What did they say?
I'm going to tell you what I said in response to, you know, this guy's an engineer.
Yeah. Okay. Which is like a diagnosis.
And what I did was, in one of the first Tae shows that I remember you giving, when I started coming here, you referred to this book by Eric Toll.
Eckhart Tolle.
I got in that book, and one of the things that was striking to me in there is what I used. I said, look, if I told you, don't think about Barack Obama, or don't think about elephants, or something like that, what happens? You think about that, okay? We're used to using our minds and assuming that we're in control of our minds, that that's who and what we are. That's the best of what we are. But if I tell you not to do that, you can't control that. What Zen helps you recognize is that there is something beyond that thinking mind that you can't control. That Zen helps you work to help develop a sense that there is something beyond that thinking mind. And there's a larger other presence that doesn't easily come under your control. And meditation is a method of moving in a way that helps you recognize that there's a place for that, but that there's something else that's a part of you. And that kind of stilled the conversation, we haven't had that since then, but we haven't had it.
But I think what Kit is demonstrating here is really fundamental.
Okay.
It's
I guess I'm just not getting.
Yeah, maybe Kit, could you talk more about what you were doing there?
Yeah, well, it was that thing that you were speaking about earlier about it's how you show up, not how you answer the question. So, I mean, there's two things that you could do. You could either just like guess. Like what I was guessing, that are you feeling worried about me or wanting more understanding about like my choices? I really want to know what's going on. Or you could express, which, you know, around being transparent, which is something like, you know, I just got to say, I feel so frustrated because I really want to be able to answer your questions in a way that helps. And I don't know how. So I just want to say that. I always love to be transparent with people. I was thinking about that even when you were speaking. About that, you know, one thing you could say is, oh, hold on a minute. You know, I just want to acknowledge that I get, like, kind of worried when someone asks me a question like that because it's so important to me to answer it in a way that I'll be happy with. Mm-hmm. Like, for me to be transparent, when I notice my energy and my thoughts, like, gush. Like,
as opposed to just being, because I end up feeling kind of defensive or
there's nothing to defend. There's nothing to do. It's more like, okay, so I can either speak about what's true for me in this moment or I could try to understand more what's going on in this organism. Those are always my choices in any moment. But usually we go right up into our head, you know, and it keeps spinning. And then we're not showing up in the way that you said is the most powerful way, which is what I loved about what you said earlier. There was no defensiveness in your answer. It was the total lack of defense and needing to prove anything to anybody, which I think is the thing that somebody would be most curious about what you spoke to earlier. It's that, you know, it's the energy.
What I said in such occasions was that I simply I came back and said I'm doing nothing special. Are you happy with your problems? do you like to get ahead on your problems? I mean to live your life in a easier way, and then they stop thinking. They and then they're more open, and then you can start explaining how it works, you know, like, do you hear the car going by or something like that, keep them out.
As a real fundamental principle, often the best way to respond is with a question.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what Kit was doing. Mm-hmm. Kit, by the way, is a very seasoned trainer in nonviolent communication, Marshall Rosenberg nonviolent communication. And
it's applied Buddhism.
Yeah.
I learned about it in this room 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. There's so much overlap between MVC and Zen and Buddhism. For example, one little point I made here while I was sitting this morning is it in terms of arguing with people? This I got this from my wife, who works some with couples who are whose marriage is on the rock, and she'll make the point: what is more important to you, to be right or to stay connected? You know, arguments.
I think there was two things that when people have asked me over the years about why, because I grew up in a really Catholic family. Everybody's like super Catholic, and so even when our daughter died here a year and a half ago, you know, we had so many people that came to her service that were like flipped out about being here, really flipped out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Service in the Buddha Hall.
Yes, the service in the Buddha Hall. So we had a lot of opportunities to ask people. I mean, like really upset almost about the statue. The whole thing was very upsetting, especially for the older generation of my family. They thought in a way that we were like sort of condemning Mal to not like, you know, even religiously. So we had a lot of opportunities to talk about this. And the two things that I said, you know, I got interested years ago in Buddhism because for me it really addresses the question about suffering in a way that I never experienced in Christianity and Catholicism. And that so troubled me that I love this religion for that. I love it. And that always calms people down when they hear that, because no one's not troubled by questions around, why is there suffering? You know, it's such a fundamental question in all of our minds and all of our lives. And then the other thing I said is that I got into it because when my kids were small, because I was aware of how much of the time I spent with them, I wasn't really there. You know, I'm spending the time with the most precious beings in my life, and I'm not even there. Like an hour will go by, and I'm supposedly sitting and playing with them, but the whole time I was off in my mind, planning, thinking, judging, you know, whatever, doing this whole thing, and I wasn't there. It was breaking my heart. So those are like the two of the things that I say to people. Like, I just, when they say what it is, I say, well, let me tell you why I got into it. And I say those two things, and people, everybody gets that. We all want to be more present for people and ourselves. And we all want to know these questions about why the hell is there so much suffering in the world?
Yeah, that's a great response. And there still might be people who are so hostile that they say, well, they might say or think, well, poor you, you're a pretty sorry person, aren't you? We don't care about those people. You can't make people receptive to it. You know, they're just too sealed off.
And in my experience, I mean, if people are, I mean, yeah, okay, I suppose you could have some random person who's just hostile for absolutely no reason, but usually if it's someone who's a friend or a family member or something, I mean, the hostility is not hostility at you. It's like they're worried about you for some reason, you know, like with my mom, I remember the first time, she just told me this like 2 years ago, when I came on staff, you know, years ago, she was so, I mean, because I had dropped out of graduate school, which in my family is like crazy, you know. And she thought it was a cult, and she didn't say anything like this to me at the time, but she was really, really, really worried about me because she knew I had been unhappy and all this stuff. Mm. And she said, when I came home for my first visit after I'd been on staff, she was like, I saw you get off the plane, and I saw your face, and I just stopped worrying, you know? because she was feeling a lot of hostility toward the Zen Center, but it wasn't about Buddhism, really. It was about, I mean, although that was the way she framed it, it was about, she was just worried about me. And once she wasn't worried about me anymore, and I think that's especially with religious stuff, people are like genuinely concerned for you, you know?
Especially if it's a parent.
Yeah, absolutely.
There can be other people, then there are also people who hear that your meditation, your religion or your meditation is a threat to their worldview. They see you as a threat.
Right.
And maybe because they're getting closer to, you know, they're feeling their system is about to crack. Roshi Kapil used to say that the person Roshi Kapil who was the founder and first president of his atheist society in high school said that the person who says, I hate God is much closer to God than the person who says, yeah, God, maybe yes, maybe no. Who knows? You know.
Yeah, so it's important to try to, and that's where the questions help, is like to try and get a sense of where that hostility is coming from. It's like, are you worried about me?
Yeah.
Are you,
yeah.
you know?
Oh, right, anger is a secondary emotion.
Right.
Yeah. So too.
Yeah. Right, right.
As long as we're talking about parents, what I tend to get from, you know, my mom, who's of course concerned about me, is maybe you should wear some makeup and jewelry. And, you know, why is it that you cut your hair off again? That is often when I try to explain with family and friends that what you see is not all there is. But it's hard to get that concisely without, you know, having an emotional reaction first.
It is, and that's where our own practice comes in. It's just exhaling and accepting that these people who are coming with these challenging questions or wanting you to be different, that's their problem, and we can't change everyone and make everyone happy. We just have to be true to ourselves.
I think also there's, for me, as I've been listening to this part of the conversation, there's a difference between someone you have an ongoing relationship with, for me, and someone that at a party or a social event where it's more of a one-time situation. I mean, that my two closest friends, when I told them about my involvement here, their reaction was violent. I mean, the one said to me, I've met a lot of people from there, and every one of them were completely fucked up and crazy.
We're doing our job.
And the other happened to be someone I was a partner in business with, and he was absolutely terrified that I was going to start preaching to these corporate clients about Buddhism. And he really embarrassed himself in a restaurant one day, just screaming at me. He was so upset. And I barely responded. I just kind of listened and nodded my head. And both of these people, I mean, it took 3 or 4 years. But now they're asking me questions. And I'm not in business with this one person anymore, but he's actually emailing me stuff that he gets about Buddhism and business practices now and calls me up and asks questions about it. So I just look at it as I've got a world of time with these folks because I continue to have some kind of connection with them. And so I just really just slow it down. And the feedback I've gotten from both of them is, boy, we've noticed such a change in you since you started going there. And that's what impacts them. So I don't feel the need to force anything.
Sometimes it's the all that can change people's minds is just time. Just time.
Why is it, though, that there's some people who just feel threatened by it?
I don't get that either.
You don't get it?
Because I think it's just they have their own belief system, whether it's religious or philosophical or something else, and these are people who can't abide differences. They want a difference, whether it's racial or ethnic or religious, is a threat. I don't know.
I have another idea about it, which is that we get most triggered about the things that we care about the most, right? I mean, if we don't care about something, there's no reason to get upset about it.
Right.
So if all of us care about these questions, about why we're here, about life, the nature of suffering, you know, death, all of it, these are like our biggest questions, right? So to me, it's not surprising that people get really attached to having their version of the answer be the right one, because it's terrifying if it's not. So to see somebody who has a really different answer to set of answers to these questions that, like, for many of us are like the driving questions of our existence, is really scary. That's it. They're just really scared because they want to trust that the answers that they've come up with for themselves are right. So that would be how I would look at it.
I've had the same thing with people telling me I'm, you know, in a cult, and a lot of people are afraid. It's strange when I first realized this. You know, I have a meditation area in my living room, and I'll be sitting, and someone walks in the door, and they're kind of afraid of you.
Spooked.
It's really strange when I first realized it. But I have when people get a little hostile with me. I have a church that's like two doors down, and I really like the pastor. I like to listen, and once in a while I'll take a walk down. and listen, and I'll say to someone, oh, I was at church the other day, blah, blah, blah. They get very upset about this. How can you go to church if you're a Buddhist?
Yeah.
Very upset. You know.
No ID check.
It was, yeah. And I try to say, you know, and then when people ask me those, you know, get hostile with me about their religion against yours, I try to get to, get rid of the traditions and all that, and what's the underlying message? You know, it's all good. No matter if you're going to the Baptist down, you know, church down the road, it's all good underneath. It's all basically the same good stuff underneath.
You were going to say something like...
Oh, thank you. My name's Gavin. I went to Interfaith Seminary. I'm reading a book called Zen in the Bible now. And can you tell them that they can deepen their own religious practice if they practice Zen and get closer to God and it doesn't interfere with that religion framework?
Yeah, here's one way to say that. I think that's very good for if it's just the right person, is to say that Zen offers a concentration practice, a way to deepen your concentration, which is the basis of all prayer. I say this at workshops sometimes. If you're presuming to pray, and if you're thinking about your shopping list at Wegmans, that's not prayer. The essence of prayer is being able to focus your mind on what you're doing, and so that's one way to talk about that. It's the basis of prayer. And
so I'm a closet Buddhist at work, but I'm a proselytizing meditator. You know, but I feel as if when you mention Buddhism, as people have said, that's a challenge to their religion. Most of them probably think Buddha is a god, and they, you know, have been taught through their religion that, you know, that's something they should stay away from. And so I go around to work doing exactly as you said, telling people who I know actually quite, you know, maybe fundamentalist Christians, very devout Christians or Jews, and I'll tell them that meditation can make them a better Christian. And I'll say, very similar to what you said, that on Sunday when you're there, what percentage of the time is your mind wandering? And so people, my company is supporting my meditation. We're having meditation sessions during lunch, but I do not really dare mention it's Buddhist. I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but these people are getting exposed. And of course, the practice seems for, you know, probably to appeal to a relative minority because it's such a difficult practice, but at least it's getting them exposed to that first step, and perhaps a small percentage of those will take that next step.
The thing to piggyback on that is that you're taking the label right out of it.
Yeah.
Taking the label of Zen right out of it.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's the labels that create separation. And, you know, and again, it goes into the beliefs that, as you mentioned earlier, that we're, you know, that we address or work with or connect with, whatever.
And if people get into meditation, at some point down the road, they're going to have a pretty positive feeling about Buddhism, because much of the science of meditation comes out of Buddhism. But first, to get them into meditation, that's skillful means.
And I don't think it's being coy. I mean, if you're talking about breath counting, it's like, well, I mean, it's, we're not really Buddhist, I've never felt like I'm sort of, hiding the ball when I'm talking to people about, basic meditation technique. Because, I think that anyone can do it, even if you hate Buddhism with the fire of a thousand suns, there's...
And here's this little factoid that I just learned last year, that the word Buddhism was coined by a 19th century missionary who went to Asia, and he saw these people practicing and saw these Buddha figures, and so he said, that's Buddhism. But there was no such word until then. Mm-hmm. In 2,500, 2,400 years, yeah. There was no such word. It was just called the Dharma, the law.
Mm-hmm. I still wanted to come back to the question of why are people threatened and things like that. And I just wanted to offer my own experience. Not that it really threatened me, but I still remember being very early on in the early 60s. I was actually like ushered into Presbyterian and Baptist like Bible schools and things. I actually had a pretty good time with that sort of thing. And I sang in the choir and everything like that. But we talked about other cultures, and you know, we'd always got on to Asian people or something like that, and talking about well, what was the difference and thing? Well, they don't believe in God, and I was like, well, what do they believe in? Well, they believe in this guy Buddha, you know, and it was just, but it was always, it always came with a sense of negativity and you know and polarization. That, you know, as we got into the Vietnam War and things like that, you know, honestly, I didn't know what Buddhism was at the time, but I knew it wasn't a good thing as far as basic, you know, American values and things like that. Like I said, to reiterate, I really didn't know what it was about, but I knew that it was kind of un-American. And I think especially when you're talking to family members that may be a little aged or something like that, there can be a little bit of that sort of thing. They just don't know what it's about, but they kind of, you know, have communist values and conflict and things like that that come kind of associated with that, that I've experienced, at least. That they really don't know what they're talking about, but they knew that there was these associations that came along with it.
I could take some more of these questions. these are some that came up in the staff meeting. Do you have to believe in rebirth in Buddhism? No. You don't. You know, in Vajrayana Buddhism, they make more of rebirth than we do in Zen. It's there was this whole debate in Tricycle magazine a few years ago between Stephen Batchelor and Robert Thurman, where Robert Thurman, who is one of the leading voices in the West of Tibetan Buddhism, said, yeah, you got it. If you're going to really go far in your practice, you have to believe in rebirth. And I just don't buy that in Zen. I believe in it. It seems perfectly sensible. As Voltaire, it's also helpful sometimes with these questions to have some quotes you can pull out of your quiver. Voltaire said, it's no more surprising to be born twice than to be born once. But there's no, in Zen is more the emphasis on now, just this, what's happening right here, right now. So, does anyone have anything they want to ask or say about that, rebirth?
It's, you can explain it that every moment is rebirth.
That's right.
That's kind of how I explain
that's
it.
Right.
That's
right.
That's right. Life, you know.
Right,
death,
right.
Birth, I just said
that's very good. Yeah. Two different kinds of rebirth.
Yeah.
What Roshi Kaplow in his book Zen Merging the East and West call the continuous rebirth, now, and then the kind of more conventional idea of what happens after you die.
You know, one more thing on that. Sometimes I'll trot out the Zen master who was asked, you know, what happens to you, what happens to a Zen master after he dies, and he said, I don't know. And they said, wait a minute, aren't you a Zen master? And of course, he said, yeah, I'm not a dead one.
Yeah. Now, seriously, if you want to feel really most effective in your answers, do some reading. You know, but we don't put a lot of emphasis on reading in Zen because the whole point is direct experience. But having some knowledge about Buddhist basic Buddhist doctrine and being able to throw a few quotes out there can be very helpful at the right time.
Alan and I, did we leave that study course in Buddhism here?
Yeah, there's a set of DVDs that Zareski's gave
us. It's like
us.
A college course in Buddhism, I think, if we left it here in the library.
Let's get that out in a Zen Arrow.
Maybe we'll publicize that.
Okay.
Yeah.
You were talking about politicians before.
Yeah.
And I do think, like, when somebody asks you a question, you can also say the answer back that you want. You may want to answer a different question than the one they asked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if somebody says, well, why do you like this? Or, you know, you can say, well, I want to tell you about how it helps me. Mm-hmm. You know, you can say, mm-hmm. Bap, what's true for you? Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have to go off thinking
yeah.
about trying to answer their
That's
question.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, like, you don't have to, yeah, we're not dancing bears. You know, someone says something to you and okay, yeah. That's right. No, that's very another basic principle. Of it also shows up in the koans a lot, where someone, a monk, throws a challenging question. You answer it in your own way. You don't have to play their game. About rebirth. Yesterday someone asked, how do you reconcile the doctrine of rebirth with an exploding world population? One answer is, I don't need to. Thank you. I don't need to. It's no problem for me. Another one is that I believe, or in Buddhism we teach that there are other worlds besides this one where you can be reborn.
This neighborhood has been coming up a lot.
Pure mosquitoes.
How can you as a Westerner practice this foreign religion here? I used to get that from my mother a lot, hissing at me, foreign religion, foreign religion. And
as opposed to the Middle Eastern sky yeah. god choice. Last time I checked.
And there too, it comes out of being feeling threatened. You know, her basic conclusion over my first 20 years in Zen was that Roshi Kapo had stolen her children and put them in a foreign religion, you know. Yeah. But one commonplace kind of answer to that is, it's historically it's been primarily a religion in Asia, but the essence of Zen is not limited to any country. It was India and China to Korea. Buddhism also in Tibet and Japan and now it's come to the West. So
you can also talk
just like Christianity. Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say too, it even did go the other direction toward the East in terms of Afghanistan. I mean, historically, you know, Afghanistan
yeah.
and parts of Iran. So it kind of went both directions.
Yeah, so that might help a little bit, but I think
yeah.
it's not, the main thing is fear on their part.
I mean,
yeah.
you could say it's influenced American, I mean, the transcendentalists were reading Buddhist stuff, and the meats, and it's not like a completely
mm-hmm.
foreign thing. It's actually
yeah.
kind of shaped.
Yeah, and then you can also, if you feel that it would be useful, you could say, you know, that's one of the main challenges here in American Zen and Buddhism, and is adapting it, because Japanese Zen is not the same as Chinese Zen. They had to adapt it to their own culture, and that's one of the big challenges we face here is adapting it to Westerners. And by the way, that was I think one of the very admirable distinctions about Roshi Kapo's teaching is that he went, I believe, further than other teachers at the time of adapting it. And, you know, for example, if you go to most Zen centers, you'll hear a lot more Japanese words, at least last I was at any. And he wanted, you know, it's one very specific way he wanted to find it, to adapt it here, is to find English equivalents when we can for things like that. But, you know, at our Zen teachers meetings, almost everything we talk about on the agenda, on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, really comes down to how do you adapt Zen, the Dharma, to the West. That's really what it's all about. That's my assignment as a teacher.
I often spoke then about this, what Roshi Kapo did, that he studied for 13 years in Japan, came back, and what he changed so that it is more accessible for Western people,
yeah,
mind.
Yeah, and this is his book, Zen: Merging of East and West, which is one that he wrote while he was teaching here. The Three Pillars of Zen was written before he ever came to Rochester. That was written in Japan. Yeah, so the Three Pillars of Zen is much more of a Japanese flavor to it, but Zen merging of East and West, he tackles all these things we've been talking about this morning. Most of them, or all of them, are in that book. So I would really urge you to read that book. And for example, one of the letters, there's a section of letters that based on real letters to him, where it says, what are you doing this meditation when you're escaping from the world and everything? Well, he spent a lot of time answering those questions in different aspects of it. So this is really helpful to read that book.
Roshi, one thing that I've often gotten that's really related to that is people who, I guess, really basically feel that religious institutions should be basically social service agencies. And I can't tell you how often I've had people say, well, why are you people sitting and meditating when you could be running soup kitchens and having daycare centers and on and on.
Yeah.
You sort of fill in the blanks.
Yeah. That's a tough question. It really is. And it's a kind of an open question. It's one of the things I struggle with is, should we be emphasizing social service more here? What I've been doing so far, it's still an open question, is it's in Taisho trying to just say, yeah, if you feel like getting involved in social service or politics, do it by all means. But I feel that my main job is to preserve the focus. You know, there's in anything, I believe that you have a choice between depth or breadth. And I think, I feel, and other teachers have different views of it, but for myself, I think my job is mainly to emphasize the depth of getting to the bottom of it all. And then you can also say that we believe that you can't ultimately help people in the purest, most fundamental way if you're bringing your egoistic tendencies to that. You can help some, and that's why we do. There are plenty of members I encourage to get involved with these things. But so that's one answer. But it's a tough one, because it's just basically it comes down to, do you believe that helping yourself is fundamentally different from helping others?
Yeah.
That's it. And once you've seen through the self, then you know that purifying your own mind, you're broadcasting. It's like Dogen. Here's another quote for you. When Dogen was criticized for not getting involved more in the civil wars in 13th century Japan, he said, "What we're trying to do here is become beacons in the world."
Yeah, I often feel that people who ask these questions, where they're really coming from is that they don't feel a deep religious faith, and basically see, like, the only excuse for churches is to be a service organization.
Or, as Roshi says in this letter, in Zen Merging in East and West, often it's because they feel guilty that they're not doing more.
Mm-hmm.
So then they want to put it on you. Why aren't you doing more? They're talking to themselves.
I remember when my sister took me to task for not sitting more.
She was sitting way more than you at the time, right?
Along that same line, I agree. Right now, the practice in this country is it doesn't have the depth yet, you know, to really kind of draw in, say, a broader base of than what's already here at this point. To maybe branch out into the other more obvious service areas. I think that's part of it too. But I wholeheartedly agree that, and I can answer for myself, because I know the more I practice, the more that I see the influence in my work and the influence I'm having. And I get this by direct feedback from the people I work with, and, how effective it is.
What about all the success Buddhists have had with nonviolence in the world, and people are seeking ways to be at peace and things like that? So that's a form of social service.
Yeah. When I went to a conference in Taiwan, a four or five day conference, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, and on the way back in the plane, one of the other speakers at the conference was a black preacher of some kind. I don't remember now, and he said to me at one point, about 8 hours into the flight, he said, "You know, you Buddhists, how I wish you had more presence at these conferences because you bring something really valuable to the conferences with your just your presence or something." And he was not talking about me necessarily, but other conferences he'd been to, and I sort of just reflected the question back to him, you know, that what we're doing in our meditation is enabling us, to whatever degree we are bringing something valuable to these conferences, that comes from not spending all our time at conferences, maybe, you know? I didn't put it quite that way, but... here's a very specific question that came up yesterday. What is the difference between Lucifer's sin of pride that resulted in him falling from heaven and Siddhartha's assertion, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world, honored one?
I don't know anyone who came up with that question.
I was asked this by one of my running buddies in D.C., who's a really devout born-again Christian, who was very interested in Buddhism, but that really bothered him for some reason.
Yeah, you just never know what people are going to fasten on. I would just say that, I mean, I think that would probably require an explanation, that when the Buddha said, above the heavens, below the heavens, I alone, the world, honored one, what we see, the most important word in that statement is the one. You know, no separation, no self or other, no us versus them, just this. Here's another one. Jesus said, no one comes to the Father except through me. Do you, as a Buddhist practitioner, feel Jesus was deluded or was lying when he said that? Well, I would say that, and any challenge like that about the Bible, what the Bible says, depending on who it is, again, I might say, how do you know he said that? Well, it's in the Bible. Well, so what? I mean, if I was feeling kind of challenging, that's what I would say. And then I would use that as a springboard to say, well, that's, you know, you may believe it, and that's, if that's good for you, great. But for me, I just, what I always liked about Zen was its emphasis on direct experience, not what the Buddha was supposed to have said, allegedly said in the sutras, in the scriptures, but his own experience. It's one way to answer that.
Sometimes I bring up the Gnostic teaching of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. You know, good one.
It's very like similar, like lift the stone and I'm there. You know, cleave the wood and you'll find me. You know, very similar to kind of a Buddhist quote. You know, or Buddhist line. I think it's,
that's great.
It's a similarity.
Yeah, or the Christian mystics.
Yeah,
a whole bunch of those. Yeah, that's great.
And there was also, I'm not sure if it's in the Gnostics or what, but even he is attributed with saying, find out for yourself.
Yeah.
The same thing that Buddha says.
He says there, the way to the Father is through me. In other words, through charity, through nonviolence, through peaceful existence. Isn't that what Buddhism is about?
Yeah. Through me, it just, as you said yesterday, it depends on what you mean by me.
Mm-hmm.
This, and from Zen perspective, this is me. Here. Here's one that has come up more than a few times over the years to me. How could the Buddha leave his family? How could, you know? It's not an easy question to answer. Especially if it comes from a wife of a Sangha member with kids. And I have sometimes said, I don't know. I just don't know. And then once you've kind of disarmed them a little bit by saying, I don't know, then you could add that in India at the time, I've read, I've heard that the family systems were much more, you know, it takes a village to raise a family. There's many, many more relatives. So according to the accounts, he didn't just abandon his child, I guess. Yeah, his wife and child. He remarried after the death of his wife. He didn't just abandon them. They were in good hands, not to mention the fact that they were in a palace. So economically, they were taken care of. But I think it'd be an unusual person, but if you sense that someone was really struggling with matters of life and death, you could say, you know, when you reach a point where you just are desperate to understand the nature of life and death, someone, I suppose, can do this kind of thing. Now, we in Zen don't recommend this, that you leave your wife and get that across. But that's a tough one.
Only your husband.
What?
Only your husband. Don't leave your wife. But, you know, there's a big precedent for it in the New Testament.
Really?
You know, because most of Jesus' disciples, they literally picked up and left. You know, like, I think that the first three disciples, they were fishermen. They were doing stuff. I'm imagining, I mean, I don't remember now if they were actually married with families, but most of his disciples literally, like, dropped what they were doing and followed him. So I don't think that it's without precedent in other faith traditions that when the Spirit calls people in a certain way or when some question becomes that compelling, that they drop it and they follow it because maybe that's what they were born to do.
Mm.
So it's not
a,
just a Buddhist thing.
And about that, you can the thing you can always draw back on is let's say that the records are true, that he left his wife and his child, but still we can't be sure of the records. And then that, again, brings you back to Zen as a practice of direct experience, you know, that we don't, that may or may not be true that he left us. It was a monastic tradition, primarily a monastic tradition, and you could see why that kind of story of him leaving his wife and child would serve the monastic system and inspire others to do the same. So nothing in the Buddhist story do I necessarily believe myself.
I could see it as he saw that there was a problem that needed to be adjusted, and I don't know how that would be received, but you can always suggest that when there's a problem, somebody has to go and get help. Did he leave them? I don't think that was his purpose. I think the idea was that he saw something important that he needed to address. You can debate over whether that was moral or not moral or whatever, but there's a sense of rescue, you know, that I have to go and fix this thing.
But
it's a bit of a reach. But
you can always say to people, it's very tricky to criticize what people do in other cultures, much less what they did in another culture 2,500 years ago.
There's a legal concept in India today of renouncing the world.
Sure.
No, I mean, like, for example, we were looking into getting involved with adoption, and they said the husband has to sign too, unless he's renounced the world. Mm. I mean, it's actually a legal. I wonder if that's from that tradition in that culture.
Mm.
Maybe that was even in that culture before the Buddha, of renouncing the world, leaving.
Probably.
It's a phase of life. Are we 90 minutes? Or how long has this gone for?
Well,
I imagine that lunch is going to terminate this.
ten more minutes at the most. Why?
I had the idea of just asking for feedback from people. It's the first time that you've done this, and it might be nice to hear from a few people just for yourself or thinking about doing it again if we've got 10 more minutes.
I think what I got out of it seems like when you're explaining to someone or answering a question, it's a subtle balance between maybe giving information and having almost like an agnostic attitude or just very humble attitude of being willing to listen to what they have to say as well and just be open-minded. Just to be very, just the way you come off. Yeah.
I think that's 90% of it.
It's realizing you have nothing to defend.
Yeah.
The minute you stop defending, you're bulletproof.
Yeah, yeah. And before I lose this thread, don't, if you really don't know, say you don't know. That's a. I mean, that too is teaching Zen. Not like, I don't know. But you know, I don't know. I suppose I should, but I don't know that. Then it gives, it clears a space where they can just sort of relax, and they're not, you're taking the sail out of their wind.
That's
right. But what about other, as far as Kit is asking about this, what we just did for the first time, any suggestions or for next time?
Maybe we could just hear from like three or four people who, how it went, or.
Well, for me, I came here because, you know, I'm still dealing with a lot of family issues around this, and this was really extremely helpful because, I don't feel so defensive. My concern is about them, and I think their concern is because they're concerned about me, and, you know, so to try and at least come to some sort of middle ground with this has been really important to me. In fact, you know, I'd say let's have another one because it's even clarified a lot of things in my own mind.
I wonder to what degree our experience with our family is very much common ground, because certainly my family has never really, they've probably asked me about Zen for about 30 seconds, you know, in the two and a half years I've practiced it, you know. It's something they don't want to talk about, and my relatives are the same way. And it's interesting. I'm guessing a lot of people have similar experiences, despite the fact that my parents are very open and supportive. It's just something that they avoid talking about. And when I want to talk about it, is, you know, what did you do this weekend? And I'm enthusiastic about it, but
talk about religion is a taboo.
Yeah.
And I said, if someone's not your same religion, I've found. I find this with my in-laws. You know, I can spend 2-3 days with all of my in-laws in Boston. None of them says a word to me about what I do for a living. Not a word. Never, never, ever. They never have. Not one word. And this is a big Italian family. And that's fine with me. I love not to talk about Zen. But it says something about them that they're...
I think for a lot of people it's a respect thing too. Like, I remember when Rob and I were getting married and we were doing the big Buddhist wedding in the Buddha Hall. I mean, people would have done, we were joking about it, you know, we could have just told people, they would have done anything. We could have been like, yes, you have to put this bag on your head and then take the goat. And they would have been like, okay.
That's what I mean. That's
and
what I mean.
Just, you know, because they don't want to.
Yeah. That's right.
I can't remember. My parents were upset when I came to the Zen Center in 1970, but they weren't as upset after they met Roshi Kapwa.
We had, he
was
back in like 1972,
it was this
sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and he, and most of us were like 20 at that time, most members of the center were low 20s, and he hatched this idea of having a parents' weekend. And I don't know how many parents came, 30 maybe, and he just took questions, and it seemed to be very successful because he was no longer just this notion in their mind, this guy, this abstraction they never met. Here he was, this warm and open guy. Oh yeah, yeah.
So it's really hard to maintain an enemy image when you're face to face with somebody.
Yeah,
that's a really powerful thing to remember. But we've just got a couple minutes. I'm just really wanting just to hear just a couple more pieces of feedback because I know this is such juicy topics.
Well, this was immensely helpful, and I also just really enjoyed this forum, sharing in a semi-structured but informal way with Sangha. So
me too.
And other topics. I mean, this kind of discussion,
I just wanted to plant the seed, picking up on that thread, Rebecca, as well as something that Kit and Deborah said, in terms of meeting you, Roshi. And it kind of ties into families and planning for death and dying. You know, I've told my family, you know, this is me now, and I would want a Buddhist funeral. Well, what does that mean? I'm not really sure. And to have a family member come here for the first time on the event, potentially my death, not knowing Roshi, not knowing what to expect.
I would love that too. I would just love to have a night where I could bring some people along in an informal thing where they could ask questions and people could explain their experiences, you know, and not come in when there's a bunch of people in robes hanging around and looking very serious. And
all of a sudden there's a crisis. And,
Alan and I are looking into burial at Chapin Mill as a, creating a cemetery there, with the possibility of.
Yeah, but you're really speaking to a way to for them to have some exposure to the center and me before your death.
And also like a family, I saw your head going to like a family, like Roshi did that parents weekend, maybe we do like a family something, you know, where people could bring and invite people in a real low threshold, not like really, you know, tons of robes, incense, the serious faces, so... We could talk about that in our development committee. It's a great idea.
It is, because, you know, when I was still working where Cecily's working now, a couple of people were sort of curious about the center, and I mentioned, you know, introductory workshops, and got the most amazing response. Like someone would say, well, can I come and just watch and not have to participate? And I think that's where they're coming from. It was just too threatening to,
It's
a
kind of open house thing.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. At workshops, no one wears robes.
Like a lot of people aren't. That's like way too big a commitment for them to.
Yeah,
like I can't see my mom going to a workshop, but she'd totally go to something that was more casual. Yeah.
We used to at our annual Zen Center picnic. We used to invite more people. It's Vesak too, but that's a little different.
Yeah.
Vesak's a lot of imagery and stuff. Picnics are, maybe,
So yes, I think this has been very helpful. Also brings to mind many other ideas.
Well, I love this. I could do this every week.
somewhere Angela, somewhere going.
I especially like it because it's an excuse to get away from it. My in-laws are here this weekend.
If they call, we'll be like, oh yeah, it's really busy.
So I just want to say, because I know sometimes in a bigger group it's hard, there's someone that really has a hard time entering in. I just want to check with anybody who hasn't had a chance to say anything yet, if there's anybody who wants to say anything. There's like four or five of us who haven't actually spoken yet.
I didn't speak. I thought this was very valuable. I mean, frankly, it's fascinating just to hear the same things that other people have experienced that I've experienced, and to hear that. Because we all have the same questions asked and posed. And so I'd do it again.
Great.